Audi.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Big Travel Podcast special, because we're back after a bit of a hiatus and we have so much in store for you for the coming season. We've got some wonderful guests as usual. We've got trips to the Maldives, to Copenhagen, to Sweden, to Berlin, Spain, possibly Saudi Arabia. That one's still in the balance at the moment, but we've got some really interesting things going on and an extra special episode to start with, actually, because this was recorded in the Maldives. A few months ago, I was very, very lucky to go on my second trip to the Maldives. Like many people, my first trip to the Maldives was actually on my honeymoon. And of course, it was very couple-y. And this time I went with a group of other women. And let me tell you, what a fantastic destination it is to go with a group of friends. We laughed like drains for the whole time. We had cocktails, we had swimming, we dived, we snorkeled, we lay on the beach, we talked and talked and talked and talked, and we just had the most wonderful, wonderful, wonderful trip. And I fully recommend it. I get asked about holidays all the time, and really this one is just ultra special. We stayed at, the first island we stayed at was one called Digali, and that's where this episode comes from. And having flown from Heathrow on British Airways with the wonderful Kuoni, we arrived at Male Airport and then got the seaplane to Digali, which was wonderful arrival, as you can imagine, on blue turquoise waters, touching down and being greeted by all the staff there and the white sandy beaches. And then after 3 nights there, we took a seaplane back to Male Airport, where we got a speedboat to the next island called Velasaru, which is, again, just absolutely divine. Both of these places are one of the, well, two of the five places owned by Universal Resorts, who are a Maldivian-owned chain, small boutique luxury chain of hotels. And what has been really, really wonderful was not just having like the whole touristy experience, but what I wanted to do, and this is bringing me around to my guest today, actually, was speak to the local people and find out, you know, what's the history of the Maldives? Like, how on earth did it become a tourist destination? When did it become a tourist destination? So it was just incredible, really. And I fully, fully recommend it. If you want to book it, give me a shout, get in touch, because I can help you do that. Anyway, I do need to get on to today's episode. So, like I said, I really wanted to speak to somebody who was born and bred in the Maldives, who really knew the place. And who better than a hotelier who was born and bred on the islands and who, having dropped out of school at the age of 14, he was kind of expelled, but not for anything really naughty, he just didn't pass his exams. He started at the very bottom of the pile in a hotel before working his way up to resort manager of Digali, one of the amazing Universal resorts. Not only do we have a great conversation about his life and how we grew up and entered hospitality, but also we talk about the development of Maldives as a tourist nation, when people started coming, what sort of impact it had on the local people. And it gives a fascinating insight into a nation we generally only see one part of. So let's give Hassan Saeed from Digali Universal Resorts a full Big Travel Podcast welcome. Dropping out of school age 14, Hassan Saeed, one of 11 siblings, had to get to work, starting at the very bottom of the pile in hospitality. We talk growing up in the islands, happy days working in his grandfather's tin workshop, entering a completely different world in tourism, spending a year at sea, being on a ferry at the time of the 2004 tsunami, navigating COVID, island culture and a happy laid-back attitude, feeling incredibly proud of the beautiful resort he's helped create, and the power of loving the community you live in. Please welcome Hassan Saeed to the Big Travel Podcast. Can you explain where we are recording this podcast? Where are we?
Right now we are sitting in the Digali suite, which is the highest category of accommodation available on Digali Maldives, which is a beautiful place in Raiatol in the Maldives, up north in the Maldives.
We're far north, aren't we here?
We are. We're about 150 kilometers north of Male, which is kind of one of the central atolls in the Maldives, in the Maldivian archipelago.
And you told me last night that we're actually 400 kilometers north of your home.
Yes, I am actually from, technically from the southern hemisphere, because we have the equator running through the Maldives, and my island is the closest landmass to the equator in the Maldives.
I had no idea that the Maldives was so big, although it's tiny in terms of landmass, but it stretches a huge distance.
We're quite narrow in terms of our archipelagic shelf, but then like we long, yeah, we extend from north to west. Yeah.
So how far is it in total, do you know, or am I just springing that on you? Because if you ask me right now how far is the, you know, Brighton from, you know, Edinburgh, I have no idea.
It's about 800 kilometres, yeah.
800 kilometres, yeah. That's a big distance.
Yeah.
I have no idea if that's the same as Brighton to Edinburgh, or I have no idea. I should have done my research.
It is. I mean, we are just a few hundred kilometres off the coast of India. And then we extend all the way into the Indian Ocean, way past the equator, probably about 30 kilometers past the equator.
And I should say that the resort we're in, you are the resort manager.
Yes, correct.
Tell us a little bit about the resort.
This is a 180-room resort. We opened in 2017. We are premium all-inclusive. Entry-level, five-star, premium luxury property. We have five restaurants and two bars, and a lot of activities, and a very, very popular kids club, beautiful spa, yeah, and a lot of activities for water sports and snorkeling, diving, everything to do with the ocean.
Yeah. And how did you get here in terms of your career path?
Well, I started about 32 years ago, and I started in an island called Elaidu in Ari Atoll, which is the second atoll to have tourist resorts in the Maldives. And I started in 1988 when I was 14 years old. I actually dropped out of school because back then we have an exam called Junior School Certificate where you had to progress from grade 7 to grade 8 and you had to pass this exam. But unfortunately, I couldn't clear that bar, and I was expelled from school.
Ooh.
And back then, my dad didn't have the means to send me to a private school, which is only available in Mali. So I was forced to work, and I chose resorts. And from there was no turning back.
But were you coming from were your family struggling? Because I've been to some local islands here on in the Maldives the last time I came here, and I haven't got the sense of, say, in countries like India where there's a huge amount of poverty and inequality. Mm. I didn't get that sense, but I'm guessing there's some level of poverty for some local people.
Yeah, back in the time where we grew up, like in the very late 70s and the early 80s, my family is quite large. We have 11, I have 10 siblings, 11
wow,
in the
seriously?
Family, yes. And I think it was more of, we weren't really, there was always food on the table, but it was a matter of, we didn't have any luxuries. We had the minimum, we had the basics, but then we didn't have any luxuries. So for my dad to be able to send me to Mali and to send me to a private school, it was not possible. But we didn't feel that we struggled because we didn't know any better. Yeah, back in those days, we had the basic provisions. I mean, there was always food on the table, and then we had fun. We had a very, very fun childhood growing up in any of these islands.
Can imagine.
And it's a wonderful childhood, yes. And you play on the beach, you know, you go around the island, you go swimming. And then back where I come from, it's a huge island. It's one of the largest islands in the Maldives in terms of size. We're about 4 kilometers in length and about a kilometer wide, and we have wetlands, so there was plenty of playgrounds for a child to enjoy.
So what did your dad do for work?
he was a civil servant, but then he retired quite early. He also worked for the State Trading Organization as a shopkeeper. He retired about 20 years ago. Basically he was a civil servant. He was a civil servant working at the island administrative office.
And did your mum work, or she looked after the 10 children, which is a lot harder work than working, by the way?
She did work on and off. Unfortunately, we lost her in 2017, the same year we opened the resort. She used to work, I mean, she used to cook for the atoll chief and the people in the atoll administration office. But that was not a permanent sort of job. It was on and off. But yeah, basically she was a housewife looking after all 11 of us.
11 children.
I have 10 siblings.
Yes. Where do you fit in the order of things?
Third. I'm the third.
You're the third.
Yes.
So you all speak together? Do you get on?
Everyone is still alive, and then we get on very well. We have massive family gatherings, and it's always fun. I think I have, I can't really remember how many nieces and nephews I have, but it could be about 12, 13 now.
Is that normal to have big families here?
Yes. I think most families would have 5 or plus children in the families back in the 70s and the 80s. But now the family size is shrinking. I think we are following the Western sort of standards as to 2 children, 2 kids, is kind of the norm now.
I'm imagining what it would be like growing up for you here. And, you know, coming from, again, we said at dinner last night that, the Maldivian people come from the same place as as Indian people originally.
Ethnically, yes.
Ethnically, yeah. Which is something I can relate to with, an Indian Fijian father. But I can imagine that you and I are the same age as well. But growing up here in the late 70s and the early 80s must have been a very different place to what it is now, because tourism was in its infancy here.
It totally is. It totally is. Because my the memories, the strongest memories that I go back to, starts with my grandfather's. He used to be a tinsmith, a metalsmith, and he had a workshop. And growing up, we had to work in that workshop. By the age of 5, 6, 7, you start helping him with the bellows, and helping him around in the workshop. So this was the kind of childhood that I remember. And back in those days, my grandfather's workshop is the kind of center of the community, of the island community, where a lot of things were produced, manufactured. They fashioned all sorts of tools and utensils, all these household utensils that you find in your kitchen, or everything was made, on the island in this shed. Oh. And then my grandfather was at the center of it. So we grew up, seeing this, looking at this, helping him out. This was a very sort of interesting, and there was a lot of curiosity for us to go and then find out what was happening. And a lot of people would visit him in the workshop, and then there was always friendly banter, jokes going around. So it was a fun kind of very fun childhood. But then like I said, we made a lot of things. There was a lot of self-sufficiency in the communities in the islands before tourism. And then my father, once he finished his work in the atoll office, in the atoll chief's residence, he would come home, and then we used to work with him in the garden, backyard garden. And then he would, he grew a lot of banana trees. We had a couple of lemon trees, mango trees. And he was tending to this every day, and we were helping him, because we had this spray pump where somebody had to, you know, pump all the time, and then he would go on spray, sometimes pesticides, sometimes, you know, nutrients. Because back in those days, we didn't have a lot of means, but then he made homemade solutions to get rid of pests and then all sorts of things. So growing up, we were a lot more productive. We were, I think if I put it into one word, I would say we were self-sufficient. Mm.
And then tourism came.
Yes, and then tourism came and everything changed, yes.
So tourism mainly started coming to the Maldives in the early 70s?
1972 is when we officially opened a resort in the Maldives, which is Kurumba Village. So the first group of tourists were Italians. Italians were already frequenting to Colombo, Sri Lanka, and Maldives became one of the places they just hopped on a plane and came for a few days just to explore. That's how it started. And then I think we started becoming more popular.
Must have been people with a lot of money, because growing up in the north of England, I knew no one that went to the Maldives, you know, nobody. People that were very push went camping in France, you know. Occasionally you'd get a very wealthy person that went to Disney. But, you know, as I say, we're the same age. These must have been very wealthy tourists that discovered this place. Do you remember your first encounter with tourism, or was it just something that you took for granted?
I think my first real encounter with tourists is after I joined the industry.
Resorts.
Yes, because back in those days, our island was too far away from the center for people to travel frequently. The tourists weren't really traveling to that far south. The tourism was sort of very much confined to Male Atoll and the atolls in the immediate vicinity, where you can travel, you know, 1 or 2 hours by boat. I think outside that zone, that was too far away.
So you were 14, you got expelled from school. Why did you get expelled from school? What did you do?
It's technically not an expulsion, because I didn't pass the exam supposed to take me from grade 7 to grade 8. I failed in maths. So, because I had to get a pass in mathematics, English, Divehi, and Islam, if I remember correctly. Those were the compulsory subjects, but I failed in maths.
You got a job as a 14-year-old. What job did you get in the resort?
It is kind of an attendant. It's not a full-time receptionist, but it was an attendant who was also doing a little bit of cleaning, reception duties. And also back in those days, we didn't have proper staff administrative offices. So I was also doing a little bit of attendance maintenance for the staff. So it was a little bit of many things, more like an attendant at the reception desk.
And how did life change for you then? Was it a different world you entered?
Totally, totally. Because we back in those days, we already started having foreigners working in the team. So when I started working, I think it was about 4 or 5 different nationalities. The resort where I joined was operated by a German company. Because in the Maldives, back in those days, Maldivian owners will develop the resort with funds that was paid in advance by tour operators. So in a way, the tour operators and the travel agents had a lot of control over the bed rights. So they effectively operated the resorts. So in our case, in my first resort, it was by a German company. Company who was specialized in diving tours. The company was called Subaqua Reisen. And we had a lot of German divers. 90% of the guests were divers, scuba divers. Yeah, and then, like I said, it was eye-opening. And then I tried learning German. It was very, very exciting. I mean, as a 14-year-old, you know, everything was very sort of, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. That sounds amazing. Did you learn English? Did you know English already at that point?
I could speak, yeah, because we start learning English from grade one. It's one of those compulsory subjects that you have to get through in school from day one. So English is the second language that we learn at school. So everybody speaks English.
Mm. And how did you, so they, working your way up from a 14-year-old job guy, you know, in the resort to the resort manager, I mean, that's a really, that's a great journey. How did it happen?
I think I'm a kind of late bloomer because it took me about 30 years to be where I am today. But then these days you have young men who become managers and general managers in about 15, 20 years. So, well, it's an exciting journey. In my case, I've actually gone sideways many times. For me, my career has not been a linear career where I always got promoted from one position to the other, and then my way was not always up. My, you know, career path had, in a lot of instances, been sideways. I went into other areas of hospitality operations just to experience and then get knowledge of how things are done. And I think I could be one of the very few resort managers who come from a human resource background, because I started off in food and beverage, front office food and beverage, housekeeping, human resources, training and development, and operations management now. So for me, it has been very, very exciting. I've done many things. I've opened guest houses. I've been on the sea on one of the dive cruise ships for a year.
Oh, my goodness, so seriously?
I've done many things, yes.
In the Maldives?
In the Maldives, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How was that?
Again, exciting. But it's a kind of solitary lifestyle. But then we do a lot of things during the day. If the weather is nice, we always have fun. Like we cruise. The cruises aren't really long. It's about 1 hour or 1.5 hours. And then we stop at a place. We do diving, snorkeling, and then always fishing, barbecues, bonfire parties. So we did a lot of fun stuff.
You're such a happy, smiley person. Is that how it's always been? Are you
I
like
think
that?
Yes.
What
yes.
you see is what you get.
Exactly.
But there actually have been a couple of difficult points, I'm thinking, in for the Maldives, for the world, during your time in hospitality, particularly difficult when it comes to hospitality. So two that I'm thinking of immediately is obviously the tsunami and also COVID. So going first towards the tsunami, the Maldives were very badly hit. And also you're so low here. Were you here? What was your experience of that?
I was actually working for a corporate office in Mali in 2004. And I was on my way to office when the tsunami happened. And you're right, we went through a lot of challenges because we were operating two resorts at the time, the company that I was working for, and both resorts were kind of destroyed and we had to rebuild from scratch, and that wasn't easy. But I think the international community and the government handled the whole situation very well, and I think we got assistance from the international community and the financial assistance that was provided to sort of rebuild the place was very, very helpful.
And from a personal point of view, where were you? Where were you when the wave came in? What do you remember of that?
I was actually on the ferry on my way from Vilingili Island, where I lived back in those days. Vilingili Island is the extended Male city, but it's about 10 minutes by boat. And we have regular ferries every 15 minutes from Vilingili to Male. And I was on one of these ferries. And, the surprising thing is...
It's probably a good place to be, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That is what, I mean, On hindsight, everybody was saying that those people who were at sea were actually the safest. And we didn't actually feel anything. When we left, I didn't really notice the water being very low. But then my fellow passengers were saying, yes, we noticed the water was very low when we left. But then when we reached Male, the water was very, very high. So there was this contrast in about 10, 15 minutes where the water went very low and then it became very high. And we went into Male Harbour, but the captain didn't go to the pier. We turned back and we went back to Willingilly.
But was your own island okay? Had it been affected?
My own island formula wasn't really affected. We are one of the safest islands in terms of the elevation and also the profile, the location of the island, because we were very much protected, and the waves didn't hit us. Because some islands, they actually lay from north to south. The waves just came from east and then washed over it. So for us, it wasn't that bad.
When did you first... So you were on the ferry, that's amazing, and yes, you didn't really know anything was going on. Mm. I remember seeing this documentary about it once, because I was very obsessed with it, because I'd been to a lot of places in Thailand and, you know, places that... And I was actually in Argentina when it hit that year. But the very year before, on Boxing Day, I'd been on Koh Phi Phi Beach, so exactly the same place that, you know, it was hit very badly. And I remember seeing this documentary. So I did a lot of reading and watching. I became a little bit obsessed with it. And I remember seeing this documentary where some people had been diving. And they were a bit like you. They didn't know anything was going on, but they looked at their watch. What's the depth? I tried diving for the first time today, but I don't remember what the watch is called that checks your depth. I don't know. Depthometer, I'm going to call it, which is probably wrong. It's definitely wrong. You know what I mean?
They call it the dive computer, I think.
But it shows the depth. And people were said, that's strange. We've just gone 10 meters or more deeper, but we haven't moved. That's really weird. And then it changed because there's this body of water moving above them. So you didn't necessarily... You were on a ferry and didn't notice.
No, we didn't notice. We didn't notice because I think there's... I mean, these days, I mean, even back 20 years, we started becoming very preoccupied with a lot of things, and we weren't really paying... We don't pay attention to our environment. We're not mindful of a lot of things that happen around us. And I think it was one of those things that I wasn't really paying attention to the tide or what was happening to the tide, whether it was high, low, because some of my fellow passengers were saying, we noticed that the water was very low when we left.
And it was unusual.
Yeah.
When did you become aware that it was a worse situation than you had experienced? How did you find that out?
So the ferry didn't go to Male, so I was not able to make it to the office. I went home, and then the telephone lines were also not working for some time. And then when the telephone line started working, I started getting phone calls from the office. And they said, look, if you're there, just stay where you are. Don't come to office. We'll try and communicate by phone. So I stayed home.
That's so interesting to see, you know, what it would be like at the on the other side of the world. You know, we were thinking of you. We all were. But the country as a whole recovered really well with tourism.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, we did. I think there was also a lot of people who were sympathetic. And then, you know, there was... it was very helpful when people... I came and then visited us, and that was, I think, what led to very, very quick recovery.
So talking of recovery, so the other low point, sorry, I do low points and high points, we do everything on the podcast, but of course in the hospitality, you know, COVID hit, which is hideous as far as I'm concerned, because it took away everything I love, you know, social contact, people, travel, people being... separated from friends and family and the people they love, places they love.
Yes.
So what was that like here?
I think my personal story when it comes to COVID is something very, very interesting, because We had family living in KL, Malaysia, for a long time. So my wife and I used to visit them very often. And it was one of those trips that we planned. We actually planned it in January. We said we want to go in March. So, and I think even late January, as early as late January, we started hearing that, you know, what is happening is in China is getting out of hand. And then I think by that time, I think end of January, you started, I think Italy was in.
Yeah, Italy was next.
Yeah. And then actually when I traveled during, there was the first few days of the pandemic when it was announced. So we went to KL and my GM at the time kept saying, look, you're traveling during a pandemic, be careful. So we still traveled and we didn't expect the whole thing to blow up and then become that dramatic. So when we came back from Malaysia, the day we came back was when Malaysia actually, the day after that was when Malaysia went into lockdown. They called this movement control order, MCO. That was when they discovered a huge, large cluster of infections through a mosque congregation. And when I came to Mali, I called my GM at the time, and then he said, no, I'm not taking you back. I mean, for the rest of the Maldives, business was still as kind of usual, but we were starting to see the first cases in the Maldives as well. I think it's been about 2-3 weeks by the time that we saw the first cases in Mali. And then he said, no, I'm not taking you back. You stay where you are, you go through your quarantine, and then that's the only way we'll take you back. And then the Maldives wanted to close borders. And they asked the resorts to send the tourists back. And then I went home to Formula. And we evacuated a lot of our staff in batches, depending on how the governments were trying to take their people back. Because most borders were being closed in April and May. Most borders were closed. So it wasn't easy. So I was in Formula until August 2020. I came back to relieve my GM back then because he had his daughter's wedding in New Zealand to attend. So I sent him back. So we opened December 2020. That was when we reopened after COVID. And during all that time, from April to August, September, we had a skeletal amount of staff on the island just to look after the property. And then we started bringing people back. We were still bringing people back after a year because business was not picking up as it was expected. It was a slow pickup. So I think by the time we kind of went back to normal levels of business, normal levels of staffing was about 1.5 years after COVID.
That's so hard for businesses, so hard, isn't it? And this is a Maldivian owned, so I should say that this is part of Digali, where we are now.
Yes.
I've heard some people say Digali and some people say Digali.
Digali.
Yeah. Where we are now, it's part of Universal Resorts, which is Maldivian.
Yes, it is. And I think our owners were, they treated us very, very well. In fact, this is my third time coming back to Universal, working with Universal, especially working with the chairman, is always an honor and a privilege because he's one of the original pioneers of tourism in the Maldives.
I'm hoping to speak to the chairman.
One of the owners, one of the investors in Kurumba Maldives, which was the first resort in the Maldives. So it's always an honor and a privilege to work for him. And he is, he values us and he is generous enough to look after all the staff during COVID when there was no business at all. And we retained 80% of our staff on payroll. Wow. And that was, everything was out of, paid out of pocket. There was no business. So, and I'm forever grateful.
Yeah, amazing.
For him, for that, yeah.
How many, what's the proportion of Maldivian people that work for the resorts, you know? It's quite a lot of local people, right?
By law, it has to be 45 and above. The minimum threshold is 45. So we right now have about 150 Maldivians, and a lot of them from the neighborhood here.
You seem like a very happy nation. Do you think that's right?
The Maldives?
Yeah.
I think that's island culture in part, because, you know, islanders everywhere in the world are kind of, yeah.
My dad's from Fiji. Happy. Yeah, there's a similar culture, yeah.
Exactly.
Islanders are happy, right?
Yeah.
Well, there's islands and there's islands. You know, I come from the UK. Yeah. It's an island culture as well, but, you know, it's not maybe the same. What makes you happy here, do you think? I mean, I know, but I just want to hear it from your words.
I think for us, we, as island communities, we worried very less. And we had a sort of self-sufficient, self-contained kind of existence through millennia, you know, for thousands of years. And I think that cultural trait still continues. I mean, it's not the same as it used to be 40, 50, 60 years ago, but I think we still maintain that sort of joviality and that community spirit.
Yeah, I get that. And it feels genuine. Like, you go to some countries where, you know, obviously we're in beautiful resorts now, so you've got to be nice to us, you know, you've got to be nice to us, but it feels genuine, you know, it feels like you're genuinely nice people. Obviously, everywhere you go, there's good and bad and hardships and easy times. What is life like for you living here on in the resort? Because you're far away from your wife, but she works as well, so...
She's looking after a school in the community, so it's not easy for her to leave the job and then come and visit me as often as we would both like to. So we kind of manage either sometimes I go to visit her, or we both go to Mali to meet each other and then travel somewhere or just spend time with our kids who are in Mali. But life in resorts, I think 30 years is, I mean, I've adjusted to this life. And for me, Digali, whatever I do with a lot of passion. And this has become a project that is very, very close to my heart, because I've been involved with this from the pre-opening stage. And everything that we've done on this island to develop it as a tourist property was done with my contribution as well. So I sort of feel very proud of the product that we have on offer right now. And I feel very much a part of what it is today. So there's no boring moment. But island life can be if you're not passionate about what you do, because it's a very small world, and you live with a group of people day in, day out, and if you don't take genuine interest in them, in their lives, in their friendships, in the bonding that you have, that can be a problem for you. So I think a long time ago I learned that I have to love the community that I live in for me to be able to do this with passion every day. So
I think that's beautiful, and I think everyone should love the community that they live in. I really do. I think that's the key to everything, is love the community you live in. I'm going to ask you my last question, which is interesting, because it's always about music.
Yes.
And because I think that travel and music go very much hand in hand.
Yes.
And I don't know what music you listen to, whether it's international music or local music, maybe a little mix. But I would ask you to name one song that reminds you of a memorable time when you were traveling? I know you travel lots. We haven't, we've talked about the Maldives, but you travel a lot. Your kids, you've got family in Kuala Lumpur. Yeah. You've been to Europe several times. You know, you've traveled the world, which we haven't got into, but you have this, you know, amazing that life that you've created from that 14-year-old. Yeah. So anyway, in your travels around the world, if I had to name you one song that reminds you of a special moment or time of travel, what is that song and where are you?
I have very different tastes in music when it comes to, I listen to different genres and different varieties of songs, and I was introduced to ballads way back in the 90s by a roommate who was very passionate about the Scorpions.
Oh, yeah. Amazing.
And I think there's this song in particular, this album, and then a couple of songs from this album, The Wind of Change, When the Smoke is Going Down, Always Somewhere. These are songs that wherever you go, I mean, those are songs that I listen to and reminds me. I mean, those are also very nostalgic tunes, nostalgic songs, and especially I think songs like Wind of Change, it has all this power to sort of connecting people together and reminding everyone that you know, it's a common humanity that we all need to share and understand each other, love each other. So I think any song from the Scorpions.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's a great choice. And that's what I love about this question, is it always gets the most interesting of answers. Yeah. And I want anyone who's listening to this, and me in the future, when I'm on a beach in the Maldives, in my head, I'm going to be listening to the Scorpions' Wind of Change. I think that's a great choice. Yeah. And I love it. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's been lovely to speak to you on the Big Travel Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you so much, Hassan. I really, really enjoyed our conversation. And actually, the next episode we have is also based in the Maldives. And we have a very, very special person, somebody who is from the family who set up Universal Resorts and just has the most interesting life. So thank you so much for listening. We'll be back very soon.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.